This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we hear excerpts from the debate between Stanley Aronowitz and Laura Flanders. The forum was entitled, Can Progressives Move the Democrats to the Left? We also hear shocking accounts of the long-term effects of Agent Orange. Vietnam veterans and the Vietnamese are suffering from this gene-altering poison. National Lawyers Guild member Jonathan Moore argued before a panel of federal judges in this ongoing legal case. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We go now to hear an excerpt from the debate between Stanley Aronowitz and Laura Flanders. The forum was entitled, Can Progressives Move the Democrats to the Left? Stanley Aronowitz is author of Left Turn, Forging a New Political Future. Laura Flanders is the author of Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Together, they discussed and debated the possibilities and the limitations of working within the Democratic Party. Let's have a listen.
I'm just going to start with one question to you, Stanley, and it may seem like an obvious one, but so how do we get from here to there? There's lots of things I would, for many of those things to happen, an awful lot will have to change. You said, you know, there's no one out there talking about these things, you know, publicly. But if there was someone out there, if there was a political formation out there discussing these things, do you think they would get on Good Morning America?
Oh, no. Oh, absolutely not. I have to say this, Gary, and it's not, this is again, the history of the left press, and I'll give you one good example, has been one where the left press has been standing out, lonely, fighting the good fight, seemingly talking to a empty forest. And then you have the case of Lester Rodney. And Lester Rodney was the sports editor and writer for the Daily Worker. And the Daily Worker was the Communist Party daily, and it had, I think, probably soaking wet at its height, 25,000 circulation. But he was a sports writer, and he's like our Dave Zirin right now. And he's speaking, by the way, this the end of this week. I would urge everybody to go hear Dave. That Lester Rodney then started to say there are no blacks in baseball, Major League Baseball, but there's a Negro League that has excellent people. And he kept on pounding on it, and the party and its periphery went out and picketed Yankee Stadium, embarrassingly, and picketed the Polo Grounds, the old New York Giant Polo Grounds on 155th Street in Manhattan, and Nevitz Field. And finally, Branch Rickey got the message and called Jackie Robinson up from the Negro League. And now, 50 years after the fact, 60 years almost after the fact, everybody recognizes the role that the communist left and its press played in bringing Jackie Robinson and finally opening the floodgates of Major League Baseball. We don't have that kind of crusading journalism on the left that can only be supported by a political formation. Otherwise, what you end up with is a lot of rich people supporting it, and they get scared every now and then. Look at the way the foundations are in the United States. the liberal left foundations. They, one thing about the liberal left foundations you will always discover, they will support community action, but the one thing they will never support financially is thought. They don't like that. Because when you think too much, that's pretty dangerous.
I thought when you were describing the group that had done all those good things, you were talking about the Black Panthers, not the Communist Party. I mean, I think there have been a few formations that have done the sort of things you're talking about, and I frankly don't see how the type of political formation that you're talking about contradicts with the one that I'm talking about. I'm saying, we can talk about it, but I'm not against this kind of a formation. I'm for it, and I believe it's happening. I just believe that some of the forming is happening inside the Democratic Party, for lack of another party. Some of the people who are members of this formulation, you don't want to call a party, are running for office and training people to run as primary challengers to rotten Democrats on the Democratic ticket, for lack of any other ticket. They're making themselves visible. The Miami Workers Center were the point of the spear of the campaign for voting rights in Miami this last election. Ken Toole and the Montana Human Rights Network absolutely talked about capitalism when they talked about the evils of for-profit energy production. A plan, the Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada, I write about in this book. They're not Democrats per se, but they do political training, political recruitment. They are advancing the kind of agenda in the media and in the public discourse, such that they got support for a whole overhaul of the state's legal system to change sentencing practices for drug addicts and created special courts. I think that's not nothing, that's something. Montana Women Vote, Conservation Vote in Montana. They're recruiting primary challengers for bad Democrats on issues of reducing, of eliminating poverty. One of the people who's running for Senate is a woman who used to head up the Women's Economic Wheel, the Women's Economic Advancement Project. Its goal is eliminating poverty. She's now in the state Senate working for statewide, national, statewide health care and support an increase in the minimum wage. I'm saying these people are doing this work, they need our help, and the sort of formulation I hear you talking about could be exactly the kind of formulation that I think is what's going to be needed now, as a lot of those folks, and including some of those liberal Democrats who worked like heck for the 2006 elections, are driven to distraction and despair and despondency by the 2008 presidential race. I mean, if we thought that the weeping was bad over John Kerry in 2004, which is to say there was sort of too much of it, there's going to be too much of it again in 2008. But frankly, when it comes to, weaseling and mealy-mouthedness about critical issues, that's not just within the Democratic Party, that's within an awful lot of our movement structures. You talked about unions. I think we also see it in the peace movement. I think they've been very measly-mouthed about a lot of things, about defiant resistance, for one thing. Why weren't the Iraq veterans against the war leading the anti-war marches of this January? Why aren't we, pushing, talk about supporting the troops? We need to support them to stop doing what they're doing. I think there's weakness within party structures and without party structures, and foundations are, all of our nonprofits, the first thing they agree to do if they want their tax deduction, if they want their donors to have a tax deduction, is agree that they won't take part in politics. That's just stupid. I want more political formations, absolutely. And I think that right now there's enough foment on the liberal side that we progressives and the left have an opportunity to shift it further to the left.
So, Stanley, it's not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, well, let me put it this way. In 1965, I was part of a little group called the SDS. I was an adult SDSer. I was 4 years older than they were. That called for a march on Washington against the war in Vietnam. We were told by many liberal senators, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't. And we did it. And then we had a bigger march and a bigger, bigger march. Remember, Clark? We had all those kinds of marches, and they told us, don't do that because it's going to embarrass the Johnson administration, and don't do that because it's going to drive the liberals away from us. And we said, let the liberals do what they do. We're going to do what we do. And Walter Reuther got upset, and he was the president of the United Auto Workers. And I'm going to get to the point. The point is, obviously, what moved towards the McGovern challenge of 1972, and boy, did he get squashed. That was That's a story that needs to be a twice-told tale. What moved towards McGovern's victory and the McGovernite victory of 1972, 70 and 72, was the movement. And the mistake that we made, and maybe this is where I'm coming from, the mistake that we made is that we did not really provide for the moments of the ebb as well as the flow of the movement. That's what we didn't do. The party moved, yes, it moved to the left in 1972, but we didn't care one way or the other, in a sense, whether they moved or not. But they moved because there was a tremendous amount of pressure from below that was pushing them in that direction. So the answer is, I think, and I gave the Flint example, that there will be people who will be trying to change the Democratic Party, and they will be trying to do things within the Democratic Party. But the truth of the matter is that if they are left to do what they do without not just the movement, which I think is a precondition, but without some kind of a political formation and some kind of national forum for the discussion of issues that go beyond what you can raise at the electoral level, then I think they will ultimately collapse. And they did in 1896. They did again in 1960s. They did in 1972. They will do it again and again because they do not have, outside of themselves, a political formation large enough and broadly enough based within the left to actually raise the ante. Gary, I think the problem of the ante is that even we on the left are too issue-oriented.
The examples that you've given, in particular the SDS and the Communist Party and Jackie Robinson, those formations came out of global movements and global, they had a material basis. So the Communist Party, you know, there was an industrial working class that supported it. There was a kind of there was a global communist movement, and then America could be part of that. Similarly, in the 60s, and civil rights and so on. There was the Vietnam War. There was a period of national liberation in Africa and racial liberation here, as well as feminism and gay rights, or in which they were steeped, and from which they would come. Where do you see this current formation coming from?
It comes from a lot of different places, and I think part of it comes from the immigrant movements. Part of it comes from the dissenting labor movements. It comes from a remnant of the anti-Iraq war movement. It comes from a rising student movement. There are now 2,500 members of SDS, of a revived SDS. It comes from parts of academia, and especially the higher education labor movement, which I'm involved in. It comes from intellectuals. Now, the problem that we have in the United States is that we don't recognize that all of these movements didn't come out of nowhere. It is the case that, I'm writing his political and intellectual biography, that C. Wright Mills and others like him in the 1950s were thinking about the possibility of a new left and were outlining the parameters of a new left in the United States. And they didn't have the political base for any of that, except the civil rights movement. And Mills was very tenured about the civil rights movement. But that it was seriously a group of intellectuals to start with who had those conversations is not to be taken lightly. I would argue, for example, in the preface, in the preamble to the rise of the of revolutionary movements around the world at the time of the Second World War, of the First World War, you also had a progressive movement, but you also had a socialist movement that was relatively small. It had a certain base in the labor movement, but it also had an intellectual foundation. What we lack now, in the first instance, is an intellectual foundation. I know it's hard for Americans to hear, but we lack an intellectual foundation. Socialism, as we've known it, has collapsed, and there are no discussions of alternatives. We are experiencing the failure of the radical imagination. We don't know the new forms. And the first step, as you asked the first time around, what are the new forms? How do we have that conversation? Was the Communist Manifesto in 1848 reflected a mass movement? There was a little revolution here and there. It's true, but the movement that they were talking about didn't exist. Communist Manifesto is a utopian document, and we need a little more utopianism.
I mean, Laura, in your book, it seems like there's quite a lot of utopianism. There's quite a lot of people dreaming about different futures, even in the most unlikely or apparently unlikely, sitting from the political comfort of New York, kind of circumstances. So people in Utah and Montana and so on.
Well, I think that there's both utopianism and very clear pragmatics. I mean, in Utah, the progressives there can't afford to write off, you know, liberal Democrats because they're the good guys. That's all they've got. They do very well electing, you know, they've got a progressive network in Utah that has managed to get people elected to office, and they say they do it by not writing anybody off in the way that the Democratic Party has written their whole state off. You know, the lack of ideological formation to go to what Stanley's talking about, surely we don't want to blame the Democratic Party for a lack of ideological formation. I mean, I would not dream of taking my ideological lead from them. But I do believe that we're not seeing the movements profile. I mean, I write in the book, I have a part, the end of the book is set in Miami, where I've come from New Orleans, I've gone to Miami, and I'm a cynic about elections. I mean, I've been trying to get my head around why people think radical change is going to come from elections since I first got my job at Air America. I feel like I went from Pacifica and WBAI, where people cared so little about elections you would hardly know they were taking place, to be Air America, where you wouldn't know anything else was taking place. You know, and this book was an attempt to kind of introduce these two audiences to each other. You know, elections are not entirely unrelated to your life, and movement politics exists. It's not just a presidential candidate on a white horse who might come and save you. Trying to get these two people to talk, these two groups to talk. I went in the book in Miami where, you know, as a cynic, I'm thinking, oh, come on. It's pouring rain. Who's going to work the polls? But the poorest possible people just for a day's pay. And I went to the poorest part of North Miami, which looked almost indistinguishable from the Ninth Ward. Public housing's been flattened by developers, not by storms. There was a great woman who said to our radio show, Mary Nesbitt, she passed away a few weeks ago. She'd lived in the projects for 26 years, and the projects had been flattened by developers 6 years ago. Thousands of people made homeless, what you were talking about before, in the promise of new development that's never happened. The place literally looks like New Orleans' Ninth Ward. She said, we had our Katrina here. Our Katrina came in walking, not blowing. People like her were working the polls, and I thought, well, what can they possibly expect from Democrats? This was ground zero for the stolen election of 2000. This was the place where Haitian immigrants were denied the right to vote. You know what happened in Miami-Dade. This was Miami-Dade County. And yet the people who were working the polls, the poorest of the poor, African Americans with the Miami Workers Center and others, talked about their dreams of change coming from Democrats. And I'm like boggled here. It's like Democrats just sold out your public housing. What are you talking about? The reality is we have failed to provide those people another place for their hopes. And at this very moment, I believe there is this upsurge happening within the Democratic electoral sphere. Will it stay within the context of the Democratic Party? I don't know. What I'm watching is this rabble who have come from outside politics, getting inside, acquiring skills, know-how, how to run for office, failing to, you know, giving up on being alienated from electoral politics. They're getting the skills and the know-how to pull the levers of power. Will they stay within the Democratic Party if the Democratic Party doesn't change things in their lives? They don't care about changing in Congress. They want change in their lives. I don't think so. And that's where I think we come in. That's where the left comes in to provide that ideological fodder to be a kind of net to catch some of these folks in. And if it's that sort of a formation that you're talking about, Stanley, I'm all for it. But, you know, I think you go to where, as an activist, you go to where the praxis is. And that's where it's happening. And frankly, this to me seems like a very exciting moment in that the forces of capital and empire after 9/11 just had their greatest ever opportunity to exercise their will on us and the world, right? And the neoliberals utterly blew it. Maybe not utterly. They've got 14 bases they want in the Middle East. But they are on the verge, let's say, of blowing it far more than we thought they would. And in the absence of leadership, in the presence of repression, you've seen an upsurge in activism around the war, around global warming, around gay marriage, for heaven's sake, around which there's been no leadership whatsoever. So I think this is a ripe moment for us to get engaged. And I guess I believe we go where the people are, and right now the people are in electoral politics. Doesn't mean you don't go to the social forum and everything else as well. You do that too. I'm going there next week.
What do you do when people come up against the leadership of the Democratic Party and disappointed? How do you save them from cynicism?
Well, the Lenin example is not a particularly good one. The reason, Gary, it's not a good one is because the Labour Party, whatever its weaknesses, was a party of a class. And it was a party of the working class of England, and it was a political system that is quite different from the United States. The Democratic Party is a party of capital. Now that's a fundamental difference. And the problem is that it presented itself for a very brief period, and I mean I won't go through the ins and outs, but for a very brief period, roughly from 1913. That is under the Woodrow Wilson administration through approximately 1938, as a party which had a serious commitment to working people, and in fact it didn't, but it did do it did respond in a very, very unique and a very important way historically. The Labour Party was a different political formation. It had factions, it had national factions. It had people like Stafford Cripps in the Independent Labour Party. I know my history, and that's a problem
in this conversation. I'm dealing in analogy here.
I understand you are. Now, look, let me just say one more thing. The reason it's not a good analogy is because of the different natures of the political system.
Well, I'll answer the question, which is what do you say to these people who are in the Democratic Party now? The people who are in Flint, who you're talking about, do you say just leave and pack up?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so then they stay, and then what?
Well, and then what I say to them, and I did say to them, is form a circle. The word circle is a political group with people in and out of the Democratic Party. Take on a confrontational issue. Make yourself troublemakers. And I believe in the city of Flint, the problem of the brownfields is troublemaking. And I say do it, whether you do it in the Democratic Party or do it outside the Democratic Party, but I argue for taking on the land question. And if I saw in Oregon or Utah, the wonderful examples, Nevada, people taking on the land question, taking on real estate capital, taking on banking capital, and if they did it in the Democratic Party, the only thing I would do would be to applaud them. I'm not a sectarian. What I'm talking about is ultimately what you need to have in order to begin to able to clarify the issues is you need an independent political formation in this country of the left, which does in fact encourage people in all sorts of places, including the unions and civic organizations and feminist organizations and so on, to begin to confront the key question of capital. And if we can do that, I don't care whether they're in the Democratic Party or not. I just don't think the Democratic Party ultimately is going to be fundamentally responsive to that kind of fight. They'll be responsive to Social Security. They will be responsive to some extent to national health care. Those are important things. But they won't be responsive to what I think is the problem, is that people don't have places to live and don't have places to work. Decent jobs. They don't have decent housing. They don't have decent ways of life. And their kids are doing worse than they did. And that's what they don't have any answers to.
I'm for the circle.
Laura, I want to ask you, on page 106 in your book, you talk about a playwright, Larry Kramer. He's a funder of radical causes. And he says, we shape what show they're in, meaning he describes the politics as a show. We shape what show they're in, what script they're reading, and when and how they read it. It's our investors who are determining what show goes up. How does the left have any kind of reasonable life within a party that is controlled by big money?
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen in the 06 election, and this is why congressional elections, I'm afraid, are very different from presidential ones, is that small money could make big difference. And we saw, I believe, the margin of victory for the Democrats in the House coming from districts they didn't even think were worth the fight. People like Carol Shea Porter, who ran on an anti-war platform in New Hampshire's 1st District, was told explicitly by Rahm Emanuel not only was her district not up for grabs, but it was in the hands of an incumbent Republican, but it was she couldn't win it. She'd been thrown out of a Bush meeting for wearing a Bush T-shirt, an anti-Bush T-shirt. She got money through grassroots sources, the internet and others, enough to employ a staff of, I think, about 6 retired peacenik grandmothers, and they all got her elected to that congressional seat. Now, you know, I think that that's more viable at the local level than it is at the federal level. But what's exciting, I believe, is that some of these folks that I'm writing about in the book, people like Oregon Action in Portland, Oregon, have been behind with local legislators the enacting of public financing of election laws. At the city level, that can expand to broader and broader levels, that can actually, if not change the national picture of elections immediately, at least bring up the conversation about different ways of organizing our electoral system. I believe change is incremental, and at the incremental level, at the local level, we can make some changes about.
In your book, you take no prisoner's attitude towards anyone doing Democratic Party work. But tonight you're saying such work is fine as long as there's an ideological and political formation that shapes and forces the issues. Are you having second thoughts?
No, I'm not. Look, it's For people who are on the left to get involved in the Democratic Party, you'll be taken over by the Democratic Party faster than you'll take over the Democratic Party any day of the week. There are people who are involved in the Democratic Party because they are operating out of certain questions and issues having to do with their own lives and their own local situations, and they want electoral expression of their ideas. I'm not about to push them out of the Democratic Party. But what I'm arguing is that unless you have something as alternative, what they're going to do is they're going to find themselves knocking their heads against the wall, and one or two things happen. They accommodate, or they become cynical about politics. I'm for a realignment of the American political system. I'm for those people who Laura actually eloquently describes are fighting for some position inside of the electoral process and inside of the Democratic Party in the local level. I'm for those people splitting at some point and helping to form something new, because otherwise they're going to get cynical. Otherwise they're going to accommodate. Otherwise they're going to get tired. Otherwise they're going to become like the people that they originally begin to fight against. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. That's the problem. And it's very much like the role that the labor movement played in the British Liberal Party in the 19th century. They had to have a labor party so that people did not continually, after the Chartist movement, bang their heads against the wall. They finally had to form a new party, which was a labor party. And it was a third party. It was a third party, Gary. It was not a second party. There were conservatives and there were liberals, and they had to form another party. And they had to do that as a result of their own experiences. And I think that's obvious what should have happened by now, but it's going to happen in the future.
I want to thank Laura, and I want to thank Stanley, and I want to thank you, the audience.
That was Laura Flanders and Stanley Aronowitz at the forum, Can Progressives Move the Democrats to the Left?
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
That's lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you. Last week in New York, a federal appeals court heard oral arguments in lawsuits about the damage brought by Agent Orange to American veterans and to Vietnamese citizens during the Vietnam War. National Lawyers Guild member Jonathan Moore gave oral arguments in this class action lawsuit. Agent Orange, named for the stripes on the barrels that contained it, was used to kill the vegetation that hid Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army units. It was found to be contaminated with the highly toxic substance dioxin. Veterans who believed they had suffered from exposure to Agent Orange sued, and in 1984, seven chemical companies settled for $180 million. Some veterans not covered by the settlement filed additional lawsuits, but U.S. District Court Judge Jack Weinstein dismissed them. He also dismissed a suit brought by Vietnamese citizens claiming to have suffered from dioxin exposure. Weinstein found that use of the toxic herbicide did not violate international norms. The Vietnam Agent Orange Relief and Responsibility Campaign held a massive rally outside the federal courthouse in New York City. We bring you the voices from that rally.
Personally, well, not any of my friends or family are involved, but I've heard from my father and my grandparents the story of the war. And I mean, as a younger generation, if they have fought for Vietnam, then we should fought for. Now is our turn to fight for whatever the consequence that the war has left. I heard that they did pay an amount of money, but I think this case is not just about the money. It's about that. Are they taking responsibility for what they've done? Are they saying that they have done something bad? The money that they're paying is not a lot for them because they benefit a lot from using those chemicals. So it's not about the money. It's about for them to say that they did something wrong and that everybody in the world see that.
We go now to interview David Klein, National Coordinator of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. David, tell us why you're out here today.
I've been to Vietnam. I was over there for an International Agent Orange conference a year ago. And then the delegation I took, which was four other vets, besides Hanoi, we went to Hue and to Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, and visited these, they're like hospices, and they're for children who are born with birth defects, you know what I mean? And there's a hospital in Saigon called Tu Du Gynecological Hospital, where many of the women who are pregnant come when they're, and they have a room in there where they keep some of these fetuses in formaldehyde. And it was like two heads fused together. I'm talking about dead fetuses now. Yeah? Arms coming out of their chests. I mean, some of the weirdest stuff I've ever seen. You know, I'm an American and I'm proud of that. When I went there, I was ashamed of being an American because it was our government that sprayed that caused those deformities. And the problem is that dioxin, in some studies, has indicated that dioxin will break the genetic chain. So you could be healthy, you get exposed, contaminated, your children are going to be contaminated. And then if you're healthy enough to get married yourself, you're going to have children that are going to be like that. But mostly, these kids, a lot of them probably ain't going to live to adulthood. You know what I mean? Like, I seen bulging eyes, and cleft feet, and missing limbs. And I seen one kid, he was writing with his feet because he had no arms. You know what I mean? But this is not, you got some bad genes, you know what I'm saying? It's like, this is a broad problem. And see, in Vietnam, a lot of the people are superstitious, or they believe in old ideas. And there's a lot of people in Vietnam who hide the fact that they have deformed children because they believe that something bad happening to you is a curse that was placed on you by, you know, an older generation, and there's a certain amount of stigmatism involved with that. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I think a lot of people don't want to say they have AIDS, but they do. You know what I mean? Because they don't want to be discriminated against. And, of course, children like that are a financial burden on the families who are not, they're not a rich country, man, you know? So it's a continuing legacy of the war, and we're supporting the Vietnamese because we believe that, in fact, it was chemical warfare. It wasn't just spraying some defoliants and, whoops, we're sorry that happened. It was a systematic use of defoliants to destroy the forests and the crops, drive the people into the villages, and they didn't give a damn if it was poisoning them or us.
We've just run into Joel Kufferman, lawyer with the National Lawyers Guild and an environmental specialist. Joel, can you briefly explain for our listeners what Agent Orange, the kinds of damage that it has wreaked on some of these plaintiffs here?
From not only was the people who directly got hit in terms of massive damages to the skin, to the respiratory situations, it caused generation upon generation of birth defects. And that's what we're beginning to see. So it's something that's gone from 1970s, and we're still seeing the after effects today. I've never seen more cases being documented in terms of photographs and medical testimony whatsoever. And also report after report showing that higher areas of concentration showing higher correlation with the effects. So we know that it's affected the citizens of Vietnam and also the American soldiers that were there.
Do you have any figures on the number of soldiers still living who are suffering from Agent Orange repercussions?
I don't know exactly, but I know it's in the thousands.
Joel, what if you make of the fact that Judge Weinstein in the past has ruled that these lawsuits, the effects of Agent Orange, do not violate international legal norms?
I totally disagree, and the premise of his argument is that, or his decision is that, Agent Orange is not a weapon, but just a pesticide. And it's totally out of character that Agent Orange, to be used to such a degree, you know, and it's such a potent chemical, it was definitely used with full knowledge that these people would be affected in the most adverse way.
Are you going to be in the courtroom today?
Yes, I am. And as a member of the National Lawyers Guild, we wrote a amicus brief for this case, and unfortunately it was rejected for being untimely. We came on board a little on the late side. Just the fact that it was rejected, we're upset that the adverse effects continue generation after generation, and we're told that they can't read our papers because it was a few weeks later.
Who's the judge today?
It's a panel of three appeals court judges.
It's a three-panel judge?
Yes.
Of the circuit court?
Of the Second Circuit, right downtown Lower Manhattan.
Do you expect the courtroom to be jammed?
I believe so. The lobby is jammed already, and there's quite a few people here that are very concerned. There's people here from Vietnam, the Vietnam victims, and American soldiers and vets alike.
Joel, we appreciate your work on behalf of the National Lawyers Guild, and we're all hoping for a positive outcome.
And I just want to point out that I think my beginning of my political conscience began in the same Foley Square where we just came from, the rally, where I attended an anti-Vietnam War rally in 1970. I think one of the first rallies there, and we're back.
Full circle.
Full circle.
Well, I'm here for the same reason that most of the other people are here, to try to get reparations for compensation for the people who have been harmed unto at least three generations so far. It have been terrible deformities on the part of the children born to the primary victims. And then some of those children now have the grandchildren of the primary victims. I understand even they are terribly deformed by this. And the earth, the water, is still contaminated. And as usual, the United States just walks away from it, you know, especially United States business. As I understand it, there's sovereign immunity. We can't sue the government, so they'll have to shoulder all the responsibility. It's their government. And those corporations are agents of big capital. They are highly subsidized. They manufacture the weapons, the chemical weapons as well, for the government to use, you know, ultimately in their behalf also. you see. It kind of goes in a circle, I think.
Did this break up?
I'm here today to support the Agent Orange victims in Vietnam who came all over from Vietnam to here, to seek the justice from the law, U.S. federal law. I think this is the crime, actually the crime that the U.S. government in the past have done to some countries, and Vietnam's were among one of those countries. And I think the government should really think of, like, they've involved now in the Iraq. I don't know who knows that they are going to attack any countries in the world and they're going to use it. So this is kind of the proofs to the, like, all everybody, the humanities, that to see that we shouldn't do it. Yeah. Actually, you know, no money can pay off for that. You can see that if you have a child and it's a deformed child, you think that any money can't survive the child? No. I think this is the money just for justice and for, I mean, it's for the human in the world to see it and to see how devil is the world is.
Well, I'm a veteran. I'm a member of the Veterans for Peace. Many of our members are Vietnam veterans. It's not only the Vietnamese people, but of course our soldiers that were affected by this chemical warfare. The hypocrisy is that the leaders of our government are always talking about the need to overthrow regimes and preemptive wars on regimes that supposedly are involved with biological, chemical weapons of mass destruction. Yet I've come to the conclusion that the United States government is the number one problem. Our government has used these weapons on so many occasions in the past that refuses also to sign international accords for inspections or for to get rid of chemical weapons. And now I hear that our government is considering manufacturing new kinds of landmines. I think that the American public has to become aware of this hypocrisy. We have to tackle these big questions. What is it about our political economic system which seems to constantly lead to war? And now we have this so-called unending war on terrorism. Frankly, I think that our government is probably involved with more terrorism than any other group. It's just that somehow state terrorism seems to not be considered as terrorism rather than unorganized non-state terrorism.
We've run into yet another National Lawyers Guild member outside of the federal courthouse. Heidi Siegfried, we're on Law and Disorder. Can you tell us why you're here? And we understand you were at the forum this past a few Saturdays ago.
Yeah, well, this past Saturday I went to the Union Hall where the various people from Vietnam that are here today to be present for their case talked about the kind of disabilities that they've been experiencing. It was pretty amazing to hear, you know, the many children that they had that were deformed or died, and then just the different cancers that they've been struggling with. And so I thought I would come down and show a little solidarity.
It's good to add to the many numbers here. Had you known much about Agent Orange before?
I mean, not a lot, really. I guess, you know, through the years I've heard about that it's, you know, got dioxin in it, and that it is a carcinogen, and that it is endocrine interrupter.
What does that mean, Heidi?
I think it interferes with your endocrine system, and I think it also contributes to the deformities that they're seeing in children.
We understand that thousands of American soldiers are still living with the long-lasting effects of Agent Orange. Were any of them there at the forum?
People didn't talk about, their exposure or, what kind of illnesses they'd had as a result. I mean, they had a lawsuit that was settled quite a while back that didn't result in very much payout per person, as I understand. Because it turned out, I think, that there was way more people that were affected than what the settlement came to,
Are you planning to be in the courtroom today?
No, I actually have to go back to work, so I just thought I'd come down for the preceding events.
We're so glad you did. Thank you, Heidi. David, can you tell our listeners what your experiences were in Vietnam and what you saw regarding Agent Orange there?
Yeah, they send you out on a mission and they give you some coordinates where you're supposed to go, and you're looking for whatever. You know what I mean? I was just a soldier. I wasn't an officer, so I didn't even know what the briefings were about, but they would take us out, and they'd have us humping. We called it humping the bush. And we'd be humping the bush and we'd come to an area that was sprayed. We'd actually go around them because we were more vulnerable in a defoliated area, just visually. You know what I mean? If there was Vietnamese, Viet Cong soldiers there, and you're walking through a defoliated area, you're highly visible. And we wasn't trying to say, here we are.
Right.
So, but they also use that stuff on crops, on rice crops.
Is that how the toxins got into some people's systems, through the rice?
Well, the rice would die from the spray. But what happens is it became in the soil and in the water. Now, as a general rule, we didn't use it. We'd sometimes fill our canteens with water, but they gave us these pills that were supposedly anti-malarial purification pills. Like the one lady, Mrs. Hung, who was on the delegation, she was a nurse with the National Liberation Front during the war. And she said that they used to have to eat a lot of greens that they'd pick in the jungles, and they'd wash them in the rivers. And they had no knowledge that the rivers were contaminated. You know what I mean? Now, eventually, sunlight will destroy dioxin. If you're in direct sunlight, eventually that would deteriorate. So the areas that are still contaminated today are up in the central highlands where there's not much drainage to the ocean, and it's heavy junk. The canopy will grow back. Them areas, and then they got what they call hot spots.
Could you explain what a hot spot is?
Well, there's two areas that were hot spots. They have a number of them identified. Surprisingly, most of the bases that the Americans flew this stuff out of, Benoit, Da Nang, they stored these poisons. Of course, anytime you got stuff kept in drums, you got a certain amount of leakage, and they're flying in 50-gallon drums of this stuff. I don't know how many, 10,000 drums stored here. So there's a certain amount of contamination on former bases. A lot of people have the idea that a soldier had to be walking in the jungle and get sprayed to get contaminated. You probably have more chance of being contaminated if you were one of the guys in the base camps. Because, it was stored there. The perimeters of base camps, they used to spray that to keep the jungle down. They used to go out there with these trucks, like oil trucks. They look like an oil truck, but they got a spraying device. And they would drive the perimeters because, they want to keep a clear zone so someone can't sneak up on you or something. It used to be an assumption you're walking through the jungle and this rain falls on you and the guy in the rear. For every soldier in Vietnam, there was 8 or 9 people doing some support capacity. Nurses, cooks, clerks, supply, truck drivers. We used to, in fact, have a division among our ourselves. I was a grunt. That's what we call an infantryman. And for every one grunt, there was eight or nine what we used to call reps. And them guys have as high a chance of being contaminated as any grunt does, you know. But that, I also want to make a point here that the use of these defoliants was not just to deny cover for the Viet Cong guerrillas or the North Vietnamese soldiers. At one point, the government adopted a strategy called strategic hamlets. And it was like based on the idea Mao Zedong said that the guerrilla is like the fish in the sea, the people are the sea. So their idea was we're going to drive the sea into these strategic hamlets, which were fortified. They're like concentration camps. And so what they did was they destroyed the land to cause an exodus of peasants into these strategic hamlets. Effectively, besides disrupting people's lives and causing a lot of misery, it was very unsuccessful because actually the Viet Cong infiltrated the strategic hamlets.
David, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.